Look up idiot in the dictionary. You know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I am your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am woefully ignorant of many films, filmmakers, and genres that consensus has deemed important. And thus I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month I'm exploring some films of the Universal Classic Monsters as recommended by Gavin Mevious, and this week's episode I'll be talking about the double feature of the original Phantom of the Opera from 1925 and the remake from 1943. Of course, this means this is the end of, not the end of October, but the end of this theme. This is the last episode, and honestly, I'm kind of sad to see it go. I was a little bit intimidated at first of this idea of doing double features, but it's been a lot of fun, not just in regards to watching these movies, educating myself on these movies, but engaging in discussions with people about them as well, and also seeing as it is the end of the month, or at least the end of the month for in regards to this theme, also means that soon the month of October will be over, which means that Halloween will be passed, which means that we'll be on to November, which is not as interesting of a month, in my opinion. But hey, you know, c'est la vie, I suppose. Okay, so I know if you've been paying attention to the last few episodes, the way that I've been divvying them up is, as you recall, sort of talking about the first film, and then a little bit about the second film, and then kind of capping it all off with sort of what connects these films, or what are sort of the similarities there, or the motivation, or at least, excuse me, my speculation as to the motivation behind why Gavin would have paired these two films together, or at least why I think they are suitable to be paired together. Some of that has been based on things that Gavin has told me, and some of that has been based on, as you know, some analyses and subjective opinions that I have seen, some threads that I have used to connect them, and you know, a lot of things that I admit are kind of personal to me. But for this episode, seeing as these are not double features, but, you know, they're in theory the same story, or I guess should say on paper sort of the same story, I think I'm going to talk about both of them at the same time, but instead of kind of talking about one movie and then the next, you know, I'm instead going to talk about three major distinctions, or at least the three areas that I see hold the biggest differences in regards to the 25 silent film and the 1943 remake Technicolor film. Or at least the ones that I saw were the most were the areas where the differences were the most significant in regards to how they signaled a change and a shift in regards to what they were trying to do with the 1925 version, with what they were trying to do with the 1943 version, which I think, despite the fact they are based on the same source material, I think they are vastly different films trying to do vastly different things. And to be honest with you, my preference for them lied in the 1925 silent version. I think in a few ways the 1943 version is sort of a wreck. I don't think it's necessarily a bad movie, but I think it is a very different movie, and one in which I have very little interest in, and certainly don't know if I will ever revisit in the future. But those three areas in which I see the differences being the biggest are the cinematography, or I guess I should say the visual aesthetic, the tone, and or the plot of the movie. You know, I see those two things tied pretty closely together. And then the presentation of the Phantoms themselves. Those are the three areas where I think the differences are the most drastic or the most telling, because you have, in both movies, you kind of have a lot of the same characters going by the same names. And the general premise is the same in regards to there is this Paris opera house, in which a cast of characters are trying to perform their craft, and yet are continuously hindered by this phantom character who we can all agree is disfigured and has an obsession with the Christine character, and comes to his demise at the end. Other than that, that's kind of the skeleton of both of these movies, but the flesh on them are very different skin tones. That's a dumb metaphor to make. But they are very different. And I guess I shouldn't keep stumbling over my words. I should kind of get into the discussion about it. So I guess you might as well. So, I mean, obviously you can... Listen, I can say the cinematography is different. You could say, well, obviously, because the 1925 film is a black and white film, with the exception of the one sequence, or the one surviving sequence, I should say, of the masquerade ball, which is shot in color, which is colored. And the 1943 version is Technicolor and widescreen and gorgeous. And so, yeah, there are those differences. But I also just mean in regards to what... Once again, kind of what both directors are trying to do in regards to how they shot it. And the 1925 one, seeing as it was a silent film and seeing as it was a black and white film, uses a lot more shadow and darkness in a way that I find really interesting. And if you are watching this movie, or if you have watched this movie, you may know that, yes, it is a very old film, but also the quality in some specific shots are super dark, almost to the point of where it's hard to see what's going on. And that, unfortunately... has to do with the fact of just like The Hitchhiker, if you recall my discussion of The Hitchhiker back from August, August or September? Yes. No, September. I'm sorry. My discussion of The Hitchhiker from September, I talked about how the version that you are seeing is pretty much a copy of a copy. In regards that the original, something happened to the original, so everything that you were kind of seeing is a result of a copy of a transfer from the original. So you're kind of seeing something which is diluted and distilled to a certain degree. And the 1925 Phantom of the Opera is the same case. It's one of those things where the rights ran out and the copyright ran out, so it kind of fell into the public domain. So these days, any version of the 1925 Phantom of the Opera that you're going to see is pretty much a copy of a copy. So even if you get your hands on a Blu-ray copy of the 1925 version, that is still a cleaned-up version of a second- or third-generation copy of the movie. So you may notice that there are some scenes which are going to be dark and not particularly great in terms of visual quality. But what they were, at least what they were trying to do with it, I thought, was... horror, you know what I mean? And of all these movies that I watch, I'd actually have to say that this one, the 25 version of Phantom of the Opera, was to me the spookiest one. Like I said, in regards to how they use darkness and how they use shadows, especially how we introduce the character of the Phantom. I mean, he really is, at the beginning of this movie, very much a Phantom. We only really, until I say maybe about halfway through the movie, we only kind of see him as a... what could be a phantom. We just see him as a shadow. We see an imprint or an impression of him. We don't actually see this phantom character. Early on, they introduced this legend of, you know, when I guess the old owners are selling it to the new owners, saying like, oh, by the way, there's a ghost here. Everyone sort of knows about it. Good luck with that. And, you know, the new owners are kind of skeptical until they see him themselves. And then they believe that there's a phantom, and everyone else believes that there's a phantom. And everyone is kind of who works in this opera house kind of accepts the fact that, hey, there is a ghost in this place and it is terrifying, but they sort of have to live with it. And a lot of that is, like I said, reinforced by this idea of how they choose to shoot the phantom early on is just through shadow and through a voice that people hear in the walls, because he knows these tunnels and he knows the inner workings of the nooks and crannies of the opera house. He very much is a ghostly figure. And that's very different from how things are. Well, let me step back a little bit. And then also just, it is dark and it is cavernous, and especially his underground lair, is a series of tunnels of booby-trapped mazes that only this guy kind of knows the ins and out of, and it feels very much like a dungeon, like a cavernous catacombs that could exist under very old Paris, and it sort of has that feel to it. Everything sort of has that an ancient sort of relic-y, which is a word I just made up, feel to it. And you do just really get the sense of something which is spooky and creepy, almost as though like the Phantom's lair could be in the basement of Dracula's castle. And in fact, he even sleeps in a coffin as sort of a reminder of his own mortality, of what people have done to him. And so there really is there's almost a gothic feel to it. I did sort of feel like the spirit was akin to Dracula, which is kind of funny because Dracula wouldn't come out for another 6 years after this one was released. But it kind of sets the template for that, you know, for dark and spooky, you know, dungeons, castles. And that's a stark contrast to what happens or what we are being shown in the 1943 version. I should say I was watching this one on the Universal Classics Blu-ray collection, which I have posted on my Facebook before. And if you have the means, you should definitely pick it up. It is worth your effort or worth your effort. It is definitely worth your money. The 1943 version was shot in Technicolor, and the Blu-ray is an amazingly gorgeous transfer, especially in the actual operatic theater scenes. It is a combination of Oscar-winning cinematography and Oscar-winning production design, rightfully so, in both of those cases, which makes it just a visual feast for the eyes, really. Everything is... at least the opera scenes, or the theater, the stage scenes... are shot on what I believe is the same theater set that was used in the 1925 version. In fact, some of the original set from 1925 is still, if not in use, is still around today. Not all of it, but some of it, making it the longest lasting or the longest used movie set in history, which is quite wonderful. So there is still a sense of grandeur and of bigness, I'll say that, in the 1943 version, but they're trying to show you a different part of it. They're trying to instead just kind of show you spectacle and warmth, because in this version, in the 43 version, everything is also, there really is nothing that's shadowy, there is nothing that's mysterious, there is nothing that's gothic. Instead, everything is very brightly and evenly lit. It doesn't feel like a horror film, because it's not trying to be a horror film. It's lit and shown instead very much like a musical, very much like you would see in the 1950s, where everything is bright and boisterous and I don't know. There's a different feel to it, and there's no sense of mystery. Even in the underground scenes, even where the Phantom in his lair, which is not even so much a lair, and I'll get to that a little bit later. But even when we sort of see the Phantom in what's supposed to be his natural habitat, you see everything, and you're aware of everything. And there isn't supposed to be, or it seems like they're not interested in the sense of mystery and tension and seediness and darkness. Instead, they are interested in brightness, in optimism, and that has to do with the fact of... I guess what I can get into the next point of the tone, what they are trying to go with, what they are trying to make instead. Because the 1925 version, and I've already sort of hit on this, it's definitely a horror film. They are definitely trying to scare you. They are definitely trying to unsettle you. They are definitely trying to tell you a story of the other with a capital O. Like I said, the Phantom is introduced very early on in the silent film version as a phantom, as a literal ghost. And we know, of course, that he is not a ghost. We know that he is a man, a admittedly deformed man, but everyone sort of thinks that he is a ghost, that he is a specter, that he is something that is outside of us and sort of otherworldly. And just the film has a lot of standard horror tropes, including, you know, getting down to, once again, something that we'll see in Frankenstein, which is going to come a few years from now, but... an angry armed mob with bats and not pitchforks but torches, ready to take on and kill and jettison this creature, this monster that they are scared of, that they are not used to. There's murder, and there's hints of darkness in the backstory of this character. It's hinted at, you know, it the film doesn't hit at it very much, but there's this idea that the Phantom is an escaped lunatic who is practiced in the black arts. They don't talk a whole lot about that, but so they're at least like, this is a villain. This is someone we should be scared of. And then in parallel to what's going on in the actual opera, the show that they are putting on is a performance of Faust. Which is something they ditched in the 1943 version, but Faust, at least the opera version, I did a little bit of research, so if you are a fan of opera, I apologize if I get any of these facts incorrect. But Faust, at least in regards to an opera version, is the story of Faust who falls in love with this character of Marguerite. He makes his deal with Mephistopheles, and long story short, Marguerite's soul gets saved, or at least there's a deal that is in place between Faust and Mephistopheles, and Faust tries to extend a deal to Marguerite. And at the end of it, there's a lot of stuff that happens. At the end, Marguerite's soul is saved, and Faust's is, well, not. And hey, if that's not the definition of foreshadowing when it comes to the Phantom of the Opera, I don't know what is. And so that's, you have that element of this story of darkness and of evil forces at play. But then on the surface, you also have the Phantom himself, who, yes, he is a deformed character, but in terms of scariness, I mean, his mask in the 25 version is creepy as all hell, man. I mean, we have this idea now of what the mask has become for the Phantom, of what this scarred or disfigured person has become, and it's sort of this white sort of half face shell thing, which has a weird sort of smoothness and slickness and beauty to it. And that all comes from the 43 version, because the mask in the 25 silent version is creepy in the sense of how neutral it is. It is just half of a face with a blank expression that has eyes and eyebrows and a nose. And it is sort of the precursor to what would come 50 years later with the Michael Myers mask, because what made the Michael Myers mask so creepy is, of course, if you want to get real snooty and filmic about it, is this idea of, because it is a blank white face with no expression, we can project anything we want onto it, anything that scares us, anything that we believe to be Michael Myers' motivation. That's what Michael Myers' motivation becomes, because he is a blank slate. In the original Halloween, he is credited as the shape. He is just a shape. He is not a person. He is not an animal. He is just a thing which seems to act out in a manner which scares us the most, because we can project it onto him, because he is not showing us expression, he is not showing us motivations. 50 years earlier, I see this in the Phantom silent version, because we just have this mask which has no expression, which has no emotion, and instead what we get is sort of what Lon Chaney gives us, and Lon Chaney is fantastic as the Phantom in this because of how expressive he is with his body, with his hands. Lon Chaney was the child, I believe, of two deaf mutes. So at an early age, he had to get used to signing with his hands, to gesturing with his hands. And he brings that gesture, that work with his body into this role, because the mask is not changing. The mask is not doing anything different. It is just a face. And yet, depending on what he says to Marguerite, how he interacts with her, how he slouches or his shoulders, or how he stands up, we get an expression, we get a mood from him because of how he acts. And that is so, so absolutely wonderful. And instead, what you have in the 43 version is sort of the precursor to the mask of this Phantom that we become used to, because it's just a very generic mask that Claude Rains as the Phantom wears just to cover up a horrible scar that he gets when acid is thrown into his face, which is once again something that I'll get into in the next point. But the 43 version is very much, like I said, the bright light and the even light and look of it is very much like it instead wants to be. If it doesn't want to be a musical, it certainly doesn't want to be a horror film. It has no interest in scaring you. It wants to intrigue you, and it wants to get you caught up in instead a love story. The 1943 version, can you hear the scorn in my voice? The 1943 version introduces not even a love triangle, because a love triangle implies that there is three people, all of whom have, you know, weird kind of twisted affections with each other. But the 43 version introduces a what seems to be a love square, because you still have our main, not our main character, I guess she is our main character, but you still have the Christine character, who is the object of the Phantom's affection. But then you also have the Raoul character, who is also quite smitten with Christine. But then the 43 version introduces this idea, this character of Anatoly, who is another opera singer, who is also quite smitten with Christine. So you have three men we're all smitten with this woman, and it just... It gets super boring because you introduce what am I trying to say here? It just is very boring to me because it then doesn't sort of make it because sort of makes the Phantom a character on the periphery instead of our main. What draws us into this movie? What is supposed to be getting us into the conflict, what is drawing us into the story of this Phantom and the shenanigans or the mayhem he is going to enact in this opera. What it is instead is love, is betrayal, is a story about obsession. And I don't want to get too deep into this just now because I want to get into it, but I mean there's certainly those elements of it in the 25 version, but the 43 version goes really into depth with this love and opens this idea to you know, thinking that we are intrigued or that we will be drawn in by these relationships between these characters on stage, forcing the Phantom off to the side, and that's not as interesting to me. It does introduce a new element, which is somewhat interesting in the sense of if there is this Phantom character that people are just kind of not seeing, and we sort of see the consequences, the after effects of what he does, it introduces this little thread, which is actually really kind of interesting in the sense of everyone sort of starts suspecting at some point that Anatoly is the real killer, that it is not the Phantom, that the Phantom is instead being blamed for these things that Anatoly is trying to do. And what is Anatoly trying to do? Well, Anatoly is trying to make Christine a star to the extent of poisoning the Carlota character. I believe that's her name in the original one. This other woman who is the lead, and Christine is her understudy, trying to get the lead out of the way so that the woman that he is in love with can rise to stardom. That is intriguing, but that's sort of the only benefit I see by bringing this love story to the fold. And in fact, I think it's actually quite detrimental because now, as time has gone by, what's the story that we have in our heads of what the Phantom of the Opera is? It's this romantic, wonderful, grandiose love story, and there are elements there, but the love isn't what interested me about the 1925 version. The love is what is sort of drawing me out of the 1943 version. It's not to say that I don't care about these characters, it's just in the context of all the other films that have come before this one, and granted, I know that chronologically the 25 version came before Frankenstein, it came before Dracula's Daughter, it came before The Invisible Man, it came before all these films, but seeing as I'm watching it now, in conjunction with, or I should say, in sequence of how all these ones have gotten, not in sequence, that's incorrect, but now that I'm watching it here, after seeing all these other ones, I'm sort of seeing how those are all tied together, and then the 43 version stands as this anomaly of this film which reeks of studio interference. And one of these things that I've, one of the themes or threads that I've talked about throughout all these episodes is this idea of things that studios do now that have pissed you off that recently have been happening for decades. One of those things certainly seems to be studio interference, which an executive had this great idea of like, hey, why don't we make the Phantom of the Opera a love story instead? Why don't we kind of get away from horror? Why don't we kind of get away from the scary stuff and instead make a crowd pleaser, make something which is going to be appealing to the masses, which isn't going to turn people away, but why don't we make something which is going to open the door for humor? There are humorous scenes in these, and this is something that I've really disliked about a lot of, or not about the movies, but there are certainly in these movies the things that I've disliked the most are when they try and sandwich in the comedic bits with these kind of oafish characters. I'm, you know, once again, I'm thinking of the guard or the caretaker from Dracula, who is sort of the doofy, goofy guy who's in charge of watching over Renfield. You had a similar cop, you know, doofy cop character in Dracula's Daughter, and here you have the stage manager who is very much believes in this idea of the Phantom, and he kind of makes the gesture of the long nose and the red beard as like, you know, like, oh, this is the one who's responsible for all this mayhem. And even the opera owners are also sort of kind of, they're not jovial, but they're kind of flustered and sort of in over their head, you know, running an opera which is not really making money, and in which things are also disappearing because this alleged Phantom character that their stage manager seems to be afraid of. It opens these doors for a lighthearted, less stressful affair, something which is going to, like I said, be more crowd-pleasing. And it's really not interesting to me because I think it gets away from I haven't read the original source material, but from what I understand, with the 25 version being the most faithful to the original source material, then I think then the 43 version gets away from what makes the source material so powerful. And I guess that's a good way to kind of get into this third point, which is just what separates these two movies, where does the real distinction lie between these two is the character of the Phantom. And frankly, what the 43 version does with the Phantom is far, far less interesting to me, despite the fact that it has Claude Rains, who is such a good actor, and he's a good actor in that movie, but just what they try to do with the Phantom character is so... I mean, I guess maybe in 1943 it was something that's revolutionary, but watching it now, I'm just so disinterested in what they're trying to do, because... And I'm starting with the 43 version this time, because I have a lot to say about the 25 version, but the Phantom... In the 1943, it essentially falls victim to Rob Zombie's Michael Myers treatment or Tim Burton's Willy Wonka treatment, in the sense of like, hey, here is this supporting side character. Let's instead make him a main character. Let's give him a backstory. Let's give him a development and explain to you where he came from, why he did what he did. And in theory, that will make him a character that you will root for. I don't want to root for the Phantom, or at least... I don't want to follow the Phantom's character arc because the Phantom as a symbol or as an idea is a lot more interesting to me than the Phantom as a guy who was a violinist who was forced out of the opera and went broke because instead of spending the money on himself and saving it up, he was using it to give the woman he loves, secretly give the woman he loves voice lessons so that she could become a star. Ugh, gag me already. I don't care about that. And I think it doesn't work. Having the Phantom as a character doesn't work for two reasons, or at least him being in love with Christine, which I guess that's what they're hinting at. It doesn't really work, or at least I should say his connection to Christine for me doesn't work for two reasons. And I guess it's not really for two reasons, but. You either can assume that he is in love with Christine, which I think doesn't work, because if so, then eventually when it gets to the end, he is kind of full-blown obsessed and he is full-blown crazy about him. So even if we felt sympathy for him at the beginning of, oh, what he initially did, why he is broke, why this guy, snaps and does what he does in the publishing house is because it's motivated out of some... out of selflessness, he does it because he loves Christine, because he wants to see her to succeed. Even if that generates sympathy for him at the beginning, he has lost all that sympathy at the very end because he is full-blown obsessed with her, because he is prepared to murder for her. He does murder for her. He murders two people for her, or at least for his goal of having her succeed. He does it for her, and he eventually, once he brings her down to his lair, you can just tell at that point he's officially gone. So... if he is in love with Christine, then that doesn't work because the sympathy that we had for him at the beginning is completely gone by the end. So he becomes he goes through not an arc, but a devolving from a likable character to an unlikable character. Or if you want to say, I believe in an initial draft, one of the initial ideas was for him to be Christine's father, which would certainly go a long way towards explaining to why he would do these things for her. But I don't think that necessarily works either, because then his obsession with her doesn't make as much sense. And then it just kind of becomes borderline creepy. So I think establishing this connection that he has to her, it's supposed to make us more sympathetic to him, but instead I think it muddles everything and kind of makes him a far less interesting character, because in the 1925 film, yes, he may have been this monstrous character, but there's something that's, if not appealing, there is something that is intriguing and there's something that is terrifying about not telling us the entire story, about wondering where he comes from, about wondering why he does what he does. And the way that they at least fill in some of the blanks, or the way that they sort of answer why he gets to the point that he eventually gets to, which is murder, is a lot more condemning of the audience, of the masses, really, which I think is a lot more interesting because, once again, just kind of explaining why he is doing what he is doing, explaining where he comes from, explaining everything about him, means that you are no longer interested in intrigue and in mystery and in I guess, terror and horror. Instead, you are just kind of, you're spoon-feeding something. You're making something pleasant and easy to swallow, and I don't like that. I don't like that because of what horror can do in regards to what it says about our relationship with each other and our relationship as people to things or people that are outside of ourselves. And Claude Rains does the best he can. You know, before he becomes the Phantom, he does a great job. You know, I do kind of feel sympathy for him. I do kind of get, you know, there's a little bit of a part of me that feels bad because, like, what he is doing out of selflessness. But then, like I said, it gets to the end and it's like, I don't feel sympathy for this guy anymore. I kind of want everything that is bad to happen to this guy because he kind of gives into obsession and kind of collapses into this downward spiral of obsession. And whatever was selfless at the beginning becomes selfish at the end. And so if I'm not supposed to be rooting for him, then who am I supposed to be rooting for? I guess there's the Christine character, but she kind of remains relatively the same, although, well, not really. I mean, she rises to prominence. She becomes the star that he set her out to be, or that he set out to make her. But she as a character doesn't really change. She doesn't, you know, she is essentially the same person, but she's just a now more famous person at the end. So am I supposed to be rooting for Anatoly, or am I supposed to be rooting for Raoul? I mean, who's the character that I'm supposed to be rooting for in this movie? Who's supposed to be going through the change? I'm not really sure, and there's really kind of no one. But Claude Rains certainly, at least in the early parts, does the best he can, because you do get that combination of his facial features, of his expression, of his eyes as well as his voice, which was, you know, not what he was working with in The Invisible Man. Having said that, once again, I fully admit that there are elements of the love story in the 1925 version. I mean, one of the reasons that the Phantom wants Christine to succeed over Carlotta, however you want to pronounce it, is because he does seem to be in love with Christine. And by seem to be, I mean he admits to being in love with Christine. So it's not as though this is something that you have to read too deeply into. The Phantom is in love with Christine. But there's also something that is twisted and tragic about not just his love of her, but also what comes of it. Because I think that there's no backstory to get to the point of well, how did he eventually come to being in love with her? You know, what was it about? They don't explain that. And I'm fine with that because of how I filled in the blanks, or at least because of the little hints that the film leaves that my mind connected the dots with instead. And so having the 25 version begin with this idea of, oh, by the way, there's a ghost here. It's been here for a while. Good luck with that. Leads me to believe that the Phantom has been haunting this opera house for a long, long time. And leads me to believe that, you know, whether it's in the caverns underground or within the walls, that the Phantom has sort of been, maybe let's call him Eric, because in the original version, his name is Eric. But so maybe Eric has just been, he's heard so many performances and he's heard so many operas and he's heard so many actresses and singers come through here. And maybe there's something about Christine which kind of made him forget about himself, made him forget that he was a deformed, rejected human being. Because in the 43 version, he is deformed because someone throws acid in his face. Because he is in the process of murdering someone and acid is thrown in his face, whereas there really is no explanation for what caused Eric to become the Phantom in this. I got the sense that he was just born that way, that he has always been deformed, that he was a guy that had always been rejected by society. And so what does he do? He escapes into what he loves. He escapes into that one thing which brings him joy and makes him forget that at that moment he is an ugly, deformed monster character. And what is that one thing that brings him joy? That one thing is the opera. That one thing is music. That one thing is this angelic voice from this woman that makes him forget that he is a monster. And so he doesn't just fall in love with Christine. He kind of falls in love with this idea of Christine, this person who elevates him out of the depths of despair. This one angelic voice that kind of makes him more than himself. He falls in love with that, and so he hopes that kind of there is a way of maybe if this woman falls in love with me, if she accepts me for who I am, then I'm going to become more than the monster that other people are going to accept me to. And that makes her rejection of him all the more tragic, because it's not just that she is in love with him, she is horrified by him. And there's this wonderful, not really scene, and not really dialogue either, but there's this title card where once she finally sees him for who he is, she says, you know, oh, you, it's you, you're the Phantom. And his response is, if I am the Phantom, it is because man's hatred has made me so. And I suppose you could interpret that as man's hatred has deformed him and scarred him, but I saw it instead as he was just a guy that was unfortunately ugly, and everyone he knew, everyone he met was so terrified of him, so intent on believing that he was a monster, that he eventually believed it himself, that he was a monster. Like, oh, well, there must be something wrong with me. I must be this monster if that's what everybody is telling me. So he escapes into the opera house to escape from all that hatred, from all that bigotry, from all that rejection. He chooses to be alone because people have convinced him that he has to be alone, that he has to be apart from them. And so her rejection of him sort of confirms the worst things that he had come to believe about himself. And so how does he respond to that? He responds to that with hatred and with rage of his own, and he murders people. He kills people because he kind of fulfills this prophecy about him. Now, that's not to say that I think his actions are justified. Well, of course he murdered. What did you expect, you jerks? No. But I think that makes him more tragic, the fact that here is a guy who... Who knows what his backstory is, you know? One little card allegedly tells us that he was a lunatic, that he dabbled in the black arts. But who knows what this guy's story was? Maybe he wasn't born a lunatic. Maybe he became a lunatic because of you know, what could be decades of social ostracization. Maybe he was a guy that had as much hope as we did one day until, you know, eventually he started believing, like, well, everyone says that I'm ugly and that I'm monstrous, so maybe I'm just a monster. Maybe I should fill the part of a monster, because that's what everyone says I am. So it doesn't justify his killings. It doesn't justify him acting out of rage, but it's almost kind of one of those things of, like, violence begets violence. If you hate this person enough, how are you going to expect anything more than hatred from him? And that I think, is so much more tragic than, oh, I was in love, And I was wronged, and so I was scarred, and so now I'm going to still try and help this woman that I love from the shadows. That's just creepy and weird. I'm much more interested in this idea of the monsters that we as people create, because it doesn't seem like there's anything inherently terrible about this person, Eric, but everyone seems to believe that he is terrible, that he is a monster, that he is to be feared, and that he is to be eventually killed. And so he sort of ends up playing that role, because what other role has been cast for him in this life other than that? Trying to fully explain him, trying to give us the 1943 Claude Rains version of, oh, look at this poor character, look at how sympathetic, look at, you know, feel bad for him. That's not as interesting to me. Because I've seen that been done so many times, and because it's... The 43 version seems to want me to pity the Phantom. Whereas the 1925 version, I have some sympathy or empathy for him. I understand how he could have gotten to that point of acting out to the point where he's so enraged that he wants to kill. I don't think that it's right, and I don't condone it, but there's a level where I can understand that he got to that point. I don't understand that as much with the 43 version, because they want me to have pity for him. And pity is sort of condescending, and there's some negative connotation to it that I don't like. Once again, because it's that thing of, am I supposed to feel sympathy for him? If so, then you've sort of negated and actually gone against that by where he ends up at the final point. And so if you're intentionally trying to make him go from sympathetic to pitiful, then there seems to be something there which is being condemned. You know, what got him to this point? I mean, it's certainly not the opera that forced him to get to that point. It's certainly not the other characters that led him to that point. It's himself. There's something inherently wrong with him that led him to that point. That was a choice he made. That was a decision he made. So then you're just kind of immediately telling me, like, okay, well, this guy shouldn't have been trusted from the very beginning. So then why am I supposed to be caring about his selflessness? I don't know. I think there's also something incredibly powerful about the ending of the 25 version, in which after Eric is sort of being chased through the streets and he gets to the river and he clenches fists and he holds his hand up and the entire crowd stops because they all expect something powerful, something destructive, something evil to be in his hand. And then Eric holds out his hand and he opens up his palm and there's nothing there. And then just before he is beaten to death and killed by the mob and thrown into the river, he laughs. And for them, I suppose they could see that laughter as confirmation of, see, this guy was a lunatic, this guy deserved what was coming to him. But I think instead, how I read it and how I saw it, because of the tragedy that is laid down for the Eric character, what I see it instead is, he's laughing because he recognizes the absurdity of, look at you people, you are so pathetic. You assumed, because you think that I'm a monster, you assumed that I had something monstrous. And he sort of recognizes the absurdity of that right before he's killed. He recognizes, I think, in that last moment, that the people that have labeled him as a monster are the monsters. And they're so monsters themselves that they assume that he is a monster as well. He opens up his hand and there's nothing there and he laughs and then he is killed. And there's something so incredibly tragic about that, that he is sort of recognizing the truth of this world that he is inhabiting. And there's a tragedy in the 25 version. There is a horrific condemnation of people and of what people don't understand and how people cast a role for the things that they don't understand that is completely lacking from the 1943 version. And yet, from what I understand, and I can't say this definitively because I have not seen other versions of The Phantom of the Opera, it is the 43 version which has inspired the later iterations that we will see. They have instead gone in the direction of this love story of this man who is so in love with this girl. And they have kind of forgotten, it seems, they've forgotten about the part of the inherent tragedy in this character who seemed like he had always been rejected by society, and they've done away then with the questions of, what will that do to someone? And were we even right to do that to begin with, just because he was different? Admittedly, horrifically different, because I didn't say anything about it, but the makeup in this, the mask that Lon Chaney wears, which is very skull-like, is absolutely terrifying, is absolutely fantastic, and from what I understand was somewhat designed or created by Lon Chaney himself, who also allegedly directed a few of the scenes because there were so many clashes between him and the director that the director stormed off, and so it was left for Lon Chaney to kind of direct some of these scenes. But there are just inherent questions about morality and about mankind in the 1925 version that are completely ditching the 43 version for the sake of safety, for the sake of a crowd-pleasing love story. And that's not nearly as interesting to me as a film which is going to question your role as an audience member in the creation of the thing that you are seeing. It is life reflecting art and art reflecting life, I believe. And that gets me into, I guess, sort of some larger observations of just what ties all of these movies together. So, you know, Dracula, why am I blanking? The Mummy, sorry. Dracula's daughter, the Invisible Man, and both of these versions of Phantom of the Opera. Or I guess if you want to simplify, just one version, just the Phantom of the Opera. What is unifying all these things? What is bringing all these things together? And this is, I have to say, this is sort of my takeaway. Once again, this is sort of what I'm seeing, and this is sort of what is helping me make sense of all these stories. And I don't necessarily mean all these individual stories, but at least sort of in regards to monster movies, in regards to this wave of monster movies, what is it that made them so alluring, that made them so powerful, that made them so resonant? And a lot of it, I think, has to do with love and sex, with an interest in the body, with a fascination of something which is foreign and outside of us. I mean, think about it. Think back to a recurring element in all these movies. You see it in Dracula. I keep wanting to say Frankenstein for some reason, but you see in Dracula, you see in The Invisible Man, you see in Dracula's daughter, you see it in The Mummy, and you see in both versions of Phantom of the Opera, in that at the core of these characters, or at least at the, what is the driving force for all these monsters, you know, both real and monstrous people, pretty much without exception, all of them, what drives all of them, what incites them to do what they do is love, or at least is an obsession with a member of, well, except in Dracula's daughter's cases, with a member of the opposite sex a lot of times. I mean, you have Dracula's obsession with Mina Harker. You have the mummy's obsession with Imhotep's obsession with the woman that he believes to be the reincarnated form of the woman he used to love. You have Dracula's daughter very much obsessed with this guy because it seems like she wants to get away from her feelings of attraction to another woman. You have the Invisible Man, who he wanted riches and fame, and he wanted to provide a better life for the woman he loves, which is why he did what he did. And of course, in the Phantom, you have the Phantom, who is obsessed with Christine. You have at the core of every single one of these movies an obsession with love, and you could say by extension an obsession with sex. And then of course, by taking sex, you could say that alludes to these things that I talked about. Vampirism kind of being a fear of infection or disease or sexually transmitted disease, specifically the idea of penetration, you know, in order of spreading this disease. Dracula's daughter, you know, the idea of if you interpret her vampirism as instead just an inability to grapple with feelings of attraction to the same sex. If you have the Invisible Man, you know, as an interpretation of a guy who is fighting against his sexual repression. There's a recurring theme here in which there is a fascination with sex, and there's a fascination with attraction, and there is an obsession to the degree for a lot of these characters of procuring their object of desire. And once again I saw that our friend Fiction Isn't Real, I mentioned him or her in one of the earlier episodes in regards to taking a bit of umbrage in regards to how Gavin and I sort of interpreted certain things. And he or her chimed in once again on the last episode, kind of having a little bit of a quarrel with what he or she believed to be reducing James Whale to just kind of being the gay director or the homosexual director, like, and I to an extent I see the validity in that comment in regards to, if I take it to a certain extent, or if taken too much of an extreme, then yeah, James Whale just becomes the gay filmmaker, and it's no longer about his skill as a director, but instead of like how can he insert his being another, and that is an other, into these movies? You know, sort of like, you know, it sort of seems like, and I can understand how someone can sort of take that as saying that, like, I am always looking at a James Whale film in regards to how is he furthering his agenda. But I'm not saying that. What I am saying, though, is that in a genre of films that deals so much with an other, which quite often is monstrous, terrifying, and out to get us, and driven by a desire, as someone who is an other, especially an other in regards to, you didn't really have openly gay filmmakers in the 1930s, how can you approach that? How can you approach art? How can you approach a mainstream form of entertainment from this perspective, from this outside perspective? How can you approach that as someone who is not part of the status quo, trying to make something for the status quo? And that's sort of a rhetorical question, because I say that in regards to, like, I am a middle-class white guy living in America. So I say that in regards to, like, I don't know what it would be like to come at it from the side, from the perspective of another, because I have really in my entire life never been an other, never seen things from that other perspective. I know how I would engage with movies if I was making them. I know how I engage with them when I watch them. I know, you know, what stories I would like to write, what stories I would like to direct. I know what kind of art I would like to create. But that is coming from the perspective of someone who has seen the world the way that I see it for pretty much my entire life. And I've never seen the world from outside of that perspective. Now, if I was even an American guy living in Britain, or if I was a white middle-class American guy living in Japan or South Korea and making art, my experience would certainly the way that I have experienced the world, and I'm now engaging with it in a different culture, in a different landscape, in a different environment, that would certainly influence how I would make my art, and then people would certainly see it from a different perspective, because they are not seeing the world that I came from, just like I am not necessarily seeing the world where they came from, or at least maybe I am seeing it, I'm just engaging it in a different way. So I can understand how someone could say, like, anyone could say, like, hey, you know, you can't just make James Whale the gay director, you can't just make these films about sex, you can't just do that, because it's reductivism in a way to kind of say that it's all about that. And I'm not saying it's all about that, but what I am saying is that at the core of a lot of these stories, there is an engagement with sexuality, whether in regards to the people who created them, or at the very least, just these things kind of existing in a world where sexuality was not very open, where things were very taboo, where you had this idea of a vampire coming after women, like, well, that's dangerous. Well, why is that dangerous? Or you have a woman vampire coming after other women, like, well, why is that strange? Why is that an outsider thing? And it even gets back to, I think, a truth, and I'm saying this with a capital T, that comes from a lot of the source material. Because think about this. Dracula, Frankenstein, The Invisible Man, these all, and The Phantom of the Opera, though I admit I don't know a whole lot about the gentleman who wrote Phantom of the Opera, but those three stories, at least, they all were based on previous source material. That's something we can all agree on. Well, let's look at the people who created that source material and how they were outside of the status quo. Frankenstein was written by Mary Shelley, a woman in a world, not just in terms of society, but also in terms of the art that she was engaging in, that was heavily dominated by men. You have Bram Stoker, who wrote Dracula, and Bram Stoker was was allegedly homosexual. I only know this because I just heard about this today on a podcast. It's the More Than One Lesson episode, in which, they're talking about werewolf movies. It's wonderful. You should go check it out. There's a few audio problems in it, but get past that because it's a wonderful, insightful episode. But if you look at Bram Stoker as a closeted homosexual who is afraid of, or didn't understand that idea of, of heterosexual interaction, then the idea of killing a vampire, of shoving a stake through the heart, and especially of the stake penetrating a woman, it's a terrifying image because you have this author who is terrified of this idea of sex with a woman. And then you also have H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells, who wrote The Invisible Man, I said that, you know, I see Wells' Invisible Man as sort of a could be interpreted as sort of a story about a guy and the destruction or the negativity that comes with, you know, kind of unleashing oneself and springing out from sexual oppression. H.G. Wells at first married his cousin, and when that didn't work out, he married a woman with and with her consent had affairs and sexual relationships with multiple women. That's not exactly repression. That's sort of, you know, kind of leading a hedonistic lifestyle, kind of doing whatever your desires, whatever your calls, whatever your biological or psychological draws, kind of giving into those things. So, I mean, I guess you can say that, well, it's not fair to make all these things about sex. It's not fair to kind of just say that all of these movies boil down to desire. But we have to admit that is part of our biology. And we see it now with, you know, the fact that there is still, you know, a struggle for equal pay and for gender equality, that this idea of engaging with another sex, that engaging with the other side of our sexuality, that engaging with what you could say is the other of a gender, that's something that has been a confusing and frustrating struggle and something that is very taboo. That's been the case for a long time in our culture. So I think it's fair, you could say, like, it's not fair that you make it about sex. But I think that we have to admit that has always been something that we have been grappling with in this culture, is that idea of how do we engage with this other gender? Because for a long time it's been to oppress it, to dominate it, to rule over it. But I think there is validity in the comment of we've kind of oppressed it, and I say we in regards to male men, to doing it to women. We've suppressed it, we've oppressed it, we've dominated it because there's been something that we are scared of and that we don't understand about it. And we think that there is something monstrous about it. We think that there is something scary about it. We think that there is something that is potentially going to be dangerous if we let it in, if we say that it's equal, if we say that it is us. But that's just my opinion. That's just my interpretation. And I know that I'm probably not going to make any friends saying that. I'm sure that probably people are going to disagree with me for it, and that's fine. But this is just sort of a revelation or conclusion that I have come to after watching all these movies, after doing research on a lot of the people that created these, after seeing where these things have come from, after seeing what was important, what was going on at the time. I've said it before, it's hard to prove a negative, but I just don't know how these things can't be factors to the people who are making them, because of the roots of where a lot of these things come from. If you haven't seen or you want to re-see any of the versions of either of the versions of Phantom of the Opera that I have talked about, the 43 version is, of course, going to be the one that is most readily available to you. You can stream it on Amazon Prime. It's available for rental and or purchase on both Apple iTunes, Google Play, and the Microsoft Store. And you can also rent it on Amazon. That's fine. As for the 1925 version, not as readily available to you. Although if you do have an Amazon Prime account, you can stream it there. And as far as I know, that's pretty much the only place that's going to be easily available for you to stream. Though it is available on home video. Home video? Do people say that anymore? There are DVD and Blu-ray versions of it, legitimate Blu-ray versions of it, but although I'm not sure why it is not in the Universal Classic Monster set, only the 1943 version is, I'm sure that has something to do with copyrights, even though it is a Carl Laemmle, I think. Did I say that right? It is a production of him, but for some reason is not included in that box set. Yeah, and I think that's pretty much all I have for those titles, which means that that's pretty much all I have for October, and that's pretty much all that I have for the Universal Classics monster movies. I am sad to see this month over, because that means that pretty soon it is going to be Halloween, and then that means pretty soon Halloween is going to be done, and then we have to wait 365 days for it to come around again. I do not have a, as is often the case, I still do not have a guest lined up for November. I have a little bit of time for this one, because I think there is, if we include the first full week of November, well, I think I have some time. I think there's like 5 or 4.5 weeks in November, so if I don't have a guest as of this moment, I think I have a little bit of time. But certainly pay attention to the Facebook page to kind of see who the guest will be, what the theme we will be talking about for November will be. I am just as curious as you may be, because as of this moment, I do not have anyone locked down. I thought I did not, so now I have to go to a plan B. Funny thing about a plan B is you have to have a plan B before you go to a plan B, so hopefully I find a plan B very soon. But this month has been a whole lot of fun. I don't know if I could say that it was the most fun theme that I did this year, but it's certainly one of them. I'm one of the reasons that I do this show is to give me a reason to watch these classic movies that I've never seen. And they don't get much more classic. They don't get much more original than these. So I'm super happy that I got to watch these. I hope that you have enjoyed this month. I hope that you've enjoyed these themes. And I hope that you've enjoyed these movies. I certainly plan to watch more now that I have this set. Maybe I'll go and actually kind of watch the Spanish version of Dracula, as Gavin told me to do. Maybe watch The Wolfman, Creature of the Black Lagoon. You know what? The world is my oyster right now. Or at least these titles right in front of me are my oyster. I don't know if that's how that phrase goes, but that's fine. That's what I did with it. So, of course, Halloween is at this point just a week away. So if you're going to celebrate it, whether you have kids and are going to take them out trick-or-treating, whether you're going out to a Halloween party, whether you're going trick-or-treating yourself, whether, you know, no matter what you're doing, I hope that you have a very happy and a very safe Halloween. I hope you have a lot of fun. I hope you watch some really great scary movies this year. But just whatever you're doing, please do it responsibly. And be sure that everyone, be sure that you do the best you can to ensure that everyone has a very safe and very happy Halloween this year. For my non-American listeners who do not celebrate Halloween, it only kind of recently occurred to me that, like, holy shit, not everyone in this, everyone who listens is American. So probably not all of them are celebrating Halloween. And probably not all of them have the same availability for titles, because I go to admittedly justwatch.com, which kind of tells you to select a region which you're going to watch your which you're going to check availability on. So, international listeners, I am sorry if these titles are not available in the same way, or if they are not as readily available. And I'm also sorry if my focusing on these particular titles and this particular theme has sort of made you feel excluded. I love Halloween. I think every country in the world should do it, but that doesn't mean that every country in the world does do it. So if you are a listener from one of those countries that does not celebrate Halloween, I still hope that you have had a really great time with this month, and with this podcast, because I know that I have. So, always easy to get in touch with me, as always, Department of Redundancy Department. YouDoMoviesBadly@gmail.com. I do movies badly on Facebook. Nolan Fixes Teeth on Twitter. Go to BattleshipRetention.com and the podcast drop-down menu, or iTunes and search for I Do Movies Badly to catch up with both back episodes and, I phrased that grammatically incorrect, to both catch up on back episodes and to leave comments if you should feel so inclined to. That about does it. So I guess I should just wrap it up. Be sure to tune in next week, where I'll be talking to, maybe not next week, maybe in 2 weeks, but just be sure to tune in next time, where I'll be talking to someone about something, and hopefully I'll be just a little bit less ignorant.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.